thanks for joining the program today. Last time, we ended talking about the Buddhist attitude to eating meat, and saw that although the Buddha did not forbid eating meat, generally it's regarded as something to be avoided. That is true especially today, when we have the financial impetus and technology to continuously kill countless animals, sometimes in the most painful ways. I personally cannot see how, if we call ourselves compassionate beings, we can justify killing animals to satisfy our craving for meat. Of course, as we quoted from both the Buddha and Thich Nhat Hanh in our last program, eating is a violent, suffering-inducing activity no matter what we put into our mouths, but this does not condone indiscriminate indulgence. The Buddha said that eating without mindfulness is like consuming the flesh of your only child. If we are mindful of the suffering we are participating in through our eating, we can do something to alleviate as much of it as possible, even if it's out of our power to stop it completely. Giving up the taste for the flesh of animals seems to me a good way to start. But now, before we continue with our discussion, let's think about motivation as we usually do. As I've said many times before, the greatest motivation is bodhicitta, the intention to free all beings from suffering and therefore to attain enlightenment. This motivation can be a big spur for us to give up the consumption of the bodies of other beings, for how can you wish to lead them to enlightenment if you are intent on chewing on their body parts? Now let's take a moment to set such a bodhicitta motivation. Thank you. Now, continuing the discussion of eating meat, for more opinions, the BBC ran a program on its analysis series on the morality of meat eating, which included the views of four professors from various universities. You can find a report on it on www.bbc.com/news/science-environment. The report is titled, Can We Justify Killing Animals for Food? And it starts off with a view of Professor Peter Singer, Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University, and the author of the book Animal Liberation. He writes, You could say that if you kill a cow, you're depriving it of the rest of its existence, which could also have been a happy, good existence. So why deprive it of that just because you want to eat some meat, when you've got other healthy, nutritious and delicious things that you could also eat? The counter-argument is this cow would not have existed if we'd not already planned in advance that at some point we would kill it and we would sell the meat, because obviously it costs something to rear a cow, and we can only meet that cost if we're going to kill it. So, in a sense, the cow could thank us for her existence. At least she has some existence rather than none. If a cow is killed, that will make it possible for another cow to come into existence who will have a good life. And if the first cow were not killed, it would not be possible for the other cow to come into existence. So, yes, this cow standing in front of us will lose the rest of her life, but that loss is replaced by bringing the other cow into existence, and the other cow will also have that happy life. Now, this argument doesn't, of course, take karma into consideration. Not only the karma that the slaughterer accumulates by killing the cows, but also the karma that the beings have to be born into that kind of life. If the second cow has the karma to be born into that life, it will be born so in due course anyway, although the conditions may be better or worse. This argument also assumes that the cows have a good life, which is kind of anthropomorphic. The professor projects happiness onto a life that may just be bearable. Buddhism, for instance, cites living without shelter in changeable weather and lack of independence as just two instances making a cow's life difficult. Add to this that cows in the dairy industry are forced to give birth continually to calves, which they are much too soon separated from and sent to the slaughterhouse as soon as they don't produce enough milk, and it becomes hard to see how the cow's life is happy, even though it may seem so to us, passing by a field where it stands placidly chewing the cud. The cow can't complain. Professor Singer does buy the first cow, second cow argument in theory, though he admits practical reservations. He continues, I say in theory because I think it's very hard to produce circumstances where that actually occurs and there aren't other undesirable side effects. Given the animals in our food supply are mostly cattle and sheep, and they are major producers of greenhouse gases, I think on balance, it would be better if they didn't exist. I think we'll come to view eating meat in the way we now look back on the Roman games, having crowds of enthusiastic people cheering on the lions as they slaughtered the Christians, or gladiators fighting each other to the death. The last time I intentionally ate meat was 1971. I grew up eating a lot of meat in Australia, and I liked it, but I really haven't missed it for a long time. And that is Professor Peter Singer. I imagine looking back from the future and viewing our current animal consumption with the same disgust we currently view the Roman games. Wouldn't that be something? Another point of view comes from Elizabeth Harmon, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Human Values at Princeton. She thinks eating meat is a moral mistake, but not morally wrong, which may be an echo of the Buddha's view. She says, "The kind of moral picture that I would urge is one in which we think about whether we can justify our treatment of individuals. If you're going to do something terrible to a particular morally significant individual, how can that be justified? Animals have moral status, and animal suffering matters because it's a harm to do something that counts morally. Killing an animal harms the animal. We're actively doing something that deprives it of future life. One way of thinking about how to justify an action is what could you say to the one that you're harming? That works very well with people. It works less well with cows who can't understand justifications. But we can imagine someone who is a representative of the cow, and what could you say to the cow's representative to justify your treatment of it? If you kill one cow, then you create another cow. That doesn't justify killing the one cow at all, in my view. I think that meat production is morally wrong, and I think that eating meat is a moral mistake, but not morally wrong. If you buy or eat meat, you're doing something that plays some kind of causal role in meat production, but it's a very removed causal role, so it's not plausible that any particular animal suffering depends on whether you make a particular purchase. So in that way, you don't have any particular bit of animal suffering or death on your head for that instance of meat eating. What you're doing is participating in the continuation of meat production, and you're also failing to participate in the vegetarian movement, which I think is a really good moral thing that's happening. She goes on, however, to admit to eating meat, though she is conflicted about it. Jeff McMahon, the White's Professor of Moral Philosophy at the University of Oxford, considers the question from the animal's moral interest in continuing to live. He says, if you didn't kill the cow, it could go on living and have a life that would be good for it. That's part of why it would be wrong for me to kill you. It would be depriving you of the good experiences that you would have if I didn't. And an animal has an interest in living to have its next meal as well. You don't have to think about humans in exactly the same way that you think about cows. But you've got to explain why you think it's permissible to do to an animal what you think it would be impermissible to do to a human being. In the case of people, their suffering matters, but their happiness also matters, and the same should be true in the case of animals. He then wonders whether it's permissible to painlessly slaughter an animal whose life so far has been good, my inverted commas, and makes a distinction between people who have nothing else to eat and those who do. I guess the Tibetans of early in the last century would fit into the former category. Due to the extremes of their climate and habitat, they could not grow anything apart from a kind of barley, so were dependent on their yaks and cattle for staples like meat, milk, and butter. In countries like America and England, there are plenty of nutritional choices other than meat, and Professor McMahon is less likely to condone their desire for animal flesh. He says, it's not at all clear that the interest that people have in killing and eating the cow outweighs the interests that the cow has in continuing to live. That's because the flesh of the cow is going to provide a certain amount of additional pleasure for the people who eat it. When we do the cost-benefit analysis here, we shouldn't weigh all the pleasure that people get from eating a meal with a cow's meat in it. We should weigh just the difference in pleasure that they would get from eating the cow and eating some meal that didn't have meat in it. My own view is that in most cases, that's not very much. I don't feel as a vegetarian that I'm in any way deprived. And I personally would agree with him. When I was younger, a big steak was a favorite. But I've been vegetarian now for nigh on 30 years, and I don't remember ever missing meat. In fact, even the thought of eating it now disgusts me. But let's continue with a view of Gary Comstock, professor of philosophy at North Carolina State University. He has quite a novel take on the practice of killing and eating animals. He views justification from the point of view of an animal's learning ability and whether the animal knows it is learning. In killing an animal, we deprive it of its ability to have a future and to satisfy its desires. So I'm very interested in whether cattle look forward, he says, and then continues, I think they do. An interesting experiment was done by Donald Broom and colleagues at Cambridge a few years ago with heifers, one-year-old cows, which seems to show not only that they can learn, but that they take satisfaction in knowing that they're learning. In the first control group, heifers learned to hit a button that led them into a long chute, at the end of which was a reward. They knew which button to push, but had no control over when the gate would open. They were interested to get to the end of the chute, but otherwise their behavior was unremarkable. A second group of heifers had control over when the gate would open. As they learned which button to push to open the gate, they got better at pushing the right button, and the gate opened faster, so they got the reward more quickly. When the second group of heifers saw their own improvements in performance, they jumped and kicked and galloped down to get the reward. Behaviors that suggest strongly that they not only anticipated the pleasure of the coming reward, but were also taking pleasure in their own role in making it happen. It seems they were aware of, perhaps even proud of it. There is a danger of anthropomorphizing the animals, of overinterpreting their behavior, but these are controlled experiments. These are not my intuitions about what I think is going on in the cattle's minds. There is also anatomical evidence. If you look at the brains and neural pathways in cattle and compare them to humans, there are massive similarities. The amygdala, the cerebellum, the thalamus, which are all involved in processing pain in us, are all found in cattle. People used to justify eating meat for biological reasons. We are omnivores. Our incisors are designed to eat meat. This is a natural thing for us to do. The problem is there are many natural things that are not right for us to do, and the biological features are irrelevant to the question of how we ought to live our lives. Evidence seems to be building that the shoe's on the other foot now, that those who want to kill animals and eat them ought to justify their view. It shouldn't be the other way around. Well, we could be accused of being a bit lopsided, but we're not going to investigate the reasons people use to kill and eat animals. We all probably know them well enough by now anyway. But we can certainly point to the enormous and unnecessary suffering that we humans inflict on the animal kingdom as a driving argument for abandoning meat eating. We can also point to huge negative effects animal farming has on the environment and climate change. According to www.stuff.co.nz, late last year, in the scientific journal Global Change Biology, the New Zealand Agricultural Greenhouse Gas Research Centre Deputy Director Dr. Andy Reisinger and Director Dr. Harry Clark published a paper about the effect of livestock emissions on global warming. Said Dr. Reisinger, "We found that of the warming the world has experienced by 2010, as much as 19% was due to direct historical methane and nitrous oxide emissions from livestock. Once you add the warming due to emissions when land is converted into pastures, you end up with a total contribution of 23% to current warming. However, their estimate didn't take into account indirect emissions from energy use or growing livestock feed like soybeans, which would increase the contribution of animal farming to global warming. The study also looked at how much livestock would contribute to future warming, and Dr. Reisinger said, if emissions from all sectors were to increase unabated, the world would warm by more than 4 degrees, but livestock would make a declining contribution to this. In other words, if the world goes to hell in a handbasket, it won't be because of livestock. But if the world makes efforts consistent with the Paris Agreement to rapidly reduce emissions from all sectors, including livestock, then livestock could still contribute almost one-fifth of the warming in 2100. That's a big part and shows that reducing livestock emissions can play an important role in helping achieve the goals of the Paris Agreement. This Duff article says the study, and I quote, also looked at how reductions in livestock emissions would impact on allowable carbon dioxide emissions consistent with long-term temperature goals. And again, it quotes Dr. Risinger with, we know that net global carbon dioxide emissions have to go to zero sometime after 2050 to limit warming to 1.5 to 2 degrees. This fact doesn't change regardless of what we do with livestock emissions. But if we could reduce livestock emissions beyond what is currently considered feasible, this would give us just a little more breathing space in that Herculean effort to phase out carbon dioxide completely. He concluded by saying that he hoped the findings helped answer any lingering questions over the role of livestock emissions have on climate change. So that is another very compelling reason to give up the eating of meat. But perhaps the most compelling for a Buddhist is compassion, and particularly bodhicitta. How can we say we are compassionate people if we are okay with killing and eating the other beings that inhabit this planet with us, or even with letting others kill so that we can eat the meat? I will attain enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings doesn't make much sense if one sees sentient beings as sources of food. And it certainly doesn't fit with the mind training slogan that started this whole discussion. Every yoga should be performed as one, which, as some commentators have pointed out, means that everything should be done with a bodhicitta motivation. But that is enough of that. Let's return to the text we've been going through, the text from which the slogan comes. For those who have recently joined the program, it is Namkar Pal's Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, and we've just started the section headed The Precepts of Mind Training. This section continues the previous one's use of slogans, the first being Every yoga should be performed as one, which we've just completed commenting on. Let's go on to the next one now. Namely, there are two activities at both beginning and end. And these slogans are not calculated to clarify, are they? But Namkar Pal gives this explanation. Just as explained above concerning the power of intention, you should set a strong resolve to eliminate unwholesome activities and acquire their antidotes. You should do this when you wake up every morning throughout your life. When you go to sleep at night, if you find that the behavior of your body and speech has been in accord with your resolve, you can rejoice, thinking that you're having found life as a free and fortunate human being, met with the teachings of the great vehicle, and come under the care of spiritual masters, has been worthwhile. But if you have not done as you had resolved, reflecting that you have worthlessly wasted your leisure and opportunities, and that your meeting with a profound teaching has been without purpose, determined not to do the same in the future. So basically, an activity in the morning is on waking up to decide that whatever we do during the day will strengthen the positive qualities of our mind and weaken the negative. While the activity in the evening is to look back to see how well we've accomplished that. We can be happy if we've mostly succeeded, and be a little stern with ourselves if mostly we haven't. But not too stern. More importantly, we have to decide not to repeat our mistakes in the future. But even that needs our compassion. We are not Buddhas, and we will make mistakes, no matter how much the Tibetan commentaries exhort us to be perfect. As the great Thich Nhat Hanh points out, we have to be compassionate with everything that we do, and that means our mistakes as well. Chogyam Trungpa and his student Pema Chodron both make this point in their commentaries to this slogan. Let's start with Chogyam Trungpa. In Training the Mind and Cultivating Loving Kindness, he translates the slogan as two activities, one at the beginning, one at the end, and says, the point of the slogan is to begin and end each day with twofold bodhicitta. In the morning, you should remember bodhicitta and take the attitude of not separating yourself from it. And at the end of the day, you should examine what you have done. If you have not separated yourself from twofold bodhicitta, you should be delighted and vow to take the same attitude again the next day. And if you were separated from bodhicitta, you should vow to reconnect with it the next day. When you get up in the morning, as soon as you get up, to start off your day, you promise yourself that you will work on twofold bodhicitta and develop a sense of gentleness towards yourself and others. You promise not to blame the world and other sentient beings and to take their pain on yourself. When you go to bed, you do the same thing. In that way, both your sleep and the day that follows are influenced by that commitment. I think that twofold bodhicitta refers to aspirational bodhicitta and engaged bodhicitta. In this context, it means that when we get up in the morning, we make the aspiration or determination to do everything with the intention to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. That is aspirational bodhicitta. And then in the evening, we look back and see if all our actions have accorded with that intention. In other words, have our actions actually been engaged bodhicitta, or just the everyday actions mostly motivated by the comforts of this life for ourselves? If we see that many of our actions have been of the latter kind, we will get no benefit by scolding ourselves or beating ourselves up. As Chogram Trungpa says, we should develop a gentleness towards ourselves with all our failings, but still recognize where we've gone wrong and try not to do so again in the coming days. Pema Chodron puts it beautifully in her commentary in her book Start Where You Are, A Guide to Compassionate Living. Following Chogyam Trungpa's translation of the slogan, Two Activities, One at the Beginning, One at the End, she writes, At the beginning of your day, when you wake up, express your aspiration. May I practice the three difficulties. May I see what I do. When it happens, may I do something different. And may that be a way of life for me. At the beginning of your day, using your own language, you could encourage yourself to keep your heart open, to remain curious, no matter how difficult things get. Then at the end of the day, when you're just about to go to sleep, review the day. Rather than using what happened as ammunition for feeling bad about yourself, about how the whole day went by and you never once remembered what you had aspired to do in the morning, you can simply use it as an opportunity to get to know yourself better and to see all the funny ways in which you trick yourself, all the ways in which you're so good at zoning out and shutting down. If you feel like you don't want to practice the three difficulties anymore because it's like setting yourself up for failure, generate a kind heart towards yourself. Reflecting over just one day's activities can be painful, but you may end up respecting yourself more because you see that a lot happened. You weren't just one way. As Carl Jung said at the end of his life, I am astonished, disappointed, pleased with myself. I am distressed, depressed, rapturous. I am all these things at once and cannot add up the sum. Now the three difficulties she talks about actually come in a later slogan which is taken out of the context of mind training like the rays of the sun. We will come to it in due course, but Pema Chodron describes them as 1. Seeing neurosis as neurosis, which means seeing what we experience and do with honesty and gentleness, even the defilements. 2. Doing something different, which means basically not following our habitual patterns. And 3. Continuing that way, in other words, continuing to do what goes against the habitual tendencies. Thus, may I see what I do. When it happens, may I do something different. And may that be a way of life for me. In her commentary on tricycle.org, Judy Leaf also encourages us not to beat ourselves up if we don't live up to our expectations. She writes, when you start your day, you could actually take a moment to think about what you're doing. Instead of just launching in, you could begin properly with something in mind beyond just getting through your to-do list. In particular, you could look on each day as an opportunity to practice Lojong or mind training. At the end of the day, before you fall asleep, instead of just flopping, you could review how you have done. You could begin by appreciating the times you were connected with bodhicitta and joined it with what you were doing. Then you could also reflect on the times when you lost your connection to bodhicitta and acted accordingly. The idea is not to beat yourself up for losing your sense of bodhicitta and mind training, nor is it to give yourself a medal for being good. You do not need to blame yourself or to blame anyone else. The idea is simply to take note so that you can shift your energy gradually in the direction of kindness and awareness. The practice of Lojong, that is mind training, is a lifelong journey, but that journey takes place one day at a time. You cannot do anything about days gone by, and speculating about the future can be overwhelming and somewhat pointless. But you can look at each day as a practice period with a beginning and an end. So every morning you take a fresh start, and every evening you have a chance to appraise how you've done. And that is where we're going to have to leave it today, for our time is now up. Thanks for joining the program today. I hope it's been of some benefit and that we can all practice as we've talked about today. Please dedicate all positive potential to gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Have a truly wonderful week. Thank you and goodbye.